on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Grammar Girl here. I'm Mignon Fogarty, and you can think of me as your friendly guide to the English language. Writing, history, rules, and cool stuff. Today, I have an interview with Dave Itzkoff about his biography of Robin Williams, his new podcast based on the book, and about writing biographies in general. Dave is a culture reporter for the New York Times, where he mostly writes about film, TV, and popular culture. Robin is his fourth book. Before we get to the interview, I do want to remind you that you can watch my new video course on LinkedIn Learning free if you have LinkedIn Premium, access to lynda.com through your library, or want to sign up for the 30-day free trial. Just search those platforms for Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing. And now, on to the interview. Well, hi, Dave. Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I have your newest book, Robin, here, and I've been reading it. And I'm wondering, you know, what inspired you to become a biographer and a memoir writer? You know, someone who writes about people instead of events or issues, for example.
I don't know if anything inspired me per se. I think that's just sort of the trajectory that my life took, my career took. You know, as a writer, you just try, I think, all different kinds of things, and you just sort of go in the direction that, you know, whichever lanes are open to you and whichever paths keep you going. I've certainly, particularly as a journalist, a lot of the stuff that I write, needless to say, is not about me, but it's often looking closely at other people's lives and delving into them to the extent that either they'll allow you or you sometimes have to push a little bit beyond what they want to tell you and see what else you can find out about them. So that's been one sort of strain of my career for a while. And the first couple of books that I wrote were personal memoirs. One, the first book that I ever wrote was a personal memoir about my own experiences in men's magazines and sort of the earliest days of my own career. And then a few years later, that book then led to the opportunity to write an essay about myself and my father, who was a drug addict for many years. And then that essay, in turn, led to the opportunity to write a book about my life with my father and his experience of getting sober and what our lives were like after that. So that those processes just kind of one facilitated the next. But at that point, also, I think I had kind of written as many memoirs as a person could when you've only been alive. I think by that point, I wasn't even 35 when, how old was I when Cocaine Sun came out? Yeah, 35. So I think after that point, that's like enough memoirs. you know, most of the writing that I did for the Times was, you know, more, it was reported pieces. It was, you know, either doing interviews, using primary sources. The next book that I wrote was just a kind of sort of straightforward classical work of journalism about Paddy Chayefsky and the movie Network. And that was a lot of archival research going through Paddy Chayefsky's papers, talking to the people from the film or from his life that were still around. That was a little bit more in line with the kinds of things I had been doing at the Times for a while. So that that kind of those are all the stepping stones.
Right. And I know the library approached you about the papers for that book. They had the writers or directors' papers that you could look through, and they were thinking it might make a good story for the Times. So how did the book about Robin Williams come about? Was that something also that someone approached you, or is it something that you came across things that you thought were really interesting? How did that happen?
It was a little complicated. I mean, for one thing, I had written about Robin quite a lot. While he was still alive for the Times, including, like, I did a long profile of him. I guess it would have been 2008, 2009, where he let me go on the road with him for a few days. And that became this whole story about basically a live comedy tour, what would end up being his last stand-up tour, really, that he had tried to do and then had to put on hold because he had heart problems and had to get open heart surgery and then recover from that. And the whole tour itself was already about the experience of him having basically relapsed into alcoholism and then gone to rehab and gotten sober and divorcing his second wife after getting out of rehab, all these really difficult things that had happened in his life. And so that was all those things were dealt with in the comedy act. And of course, things that he and I had to talk about in my interviews and conversations with him. So I got a little taste of his world through that experience and got to meet his manager and his older son, Zach. And you know, he and I, you know, I'd write about him, you know, every couple of years, whether it was for when he came to New York to do his Broadway show, or when he, I did a profile of Billy Crystal that, of course, Robin was part of. And then, sadly, I wrote his obituary for the Times because that was a situation where we had literally nothing on file, nothing ready to publish for him because nobody had any expectation that he would die so soon. So after all those experiences, it just seemed sort of understandable that, you know, the publishers would be interested in at least speaking to me about doing a book. And I, on my end, wanted to feel out some people in Robin's world, both on in his family and in his sort of professional circles, just to see how people would feel. Not to say, can I have your permission, but just to make sure if I were to go ahead and do this, how would you feel? Because it was a tremendously sensitive subject. And even in the course of writing the book, a lot of the details of his death, that's only when we started learning, you know, really what had happened in his last kind of days and even hours of his life. So we had to
right.
Really,
and didn't he have Lewy body dementia, and most people didn't know that.
No, that was well. That's exactly that's what had happened, and that was completely unknown at the time of his death. It would take months for essentially his autopsy to be completed, and that was all turned up in the autopsy. That was not, you know, he certainly was going through a lot of what, in retrospect, people now understand were symptoms of that disease, but it was not anything he'd been formally diagnosed with before he died. So all of which is to say that, you know, as I'm approaching people either to say, this is a book I'd like to write, or is this a book you'd participate in, people are still grieving for him. And we knew it was going to be a process of, you know, approaching people very gently and being patient, waiting for people to at least feel like they were in a place that they might want to talk about him, being understanding of people that didn't want to participate because those memories were either too sensitive or that were just so intensely personal for them that they didn't want to share them with anybody else, and being understanding of that.
Right. I was wondering about that because he was really open with you, which sounds amazing. And then I was wondering how it was talking to his friends and family and colleagues, and if you had any people who were more reluctant. And, you know, as a biographer, what can you do to, you know, either try to coax the people to talk to you or maybe find information in other ways if people just won't talk to you? You know, how do you make sure you're providing a balanced view of that person's life and getting the whole big picture.
Yeah. I mean, this is such a sort of unique case in a way because of all the sensitivities and the tragedy that we talked about. And the one thing I knew, not with absolute certainty, but going in, I had some communication with Zach, Robin's older son, and he at least gave an indication that at a certain point he might be open to talking with me, and that gave me a certain amount of reassurance that at least if somebody that pivotal in Robin's own family was potentially available or thinking about it, then that might be something to build on. But that was it took almost 2 years before Zach was in a position to speak with me, partly because of just what he was dealing with and what his siblings were dealing with. And then there were some legal issues going on within the family over Robin's estate. And so that, that all had to be resolved, too. So in the meantime, I just tried to talk around to people that perhaps didn't have a direct connection to the family or weren't so central that it might seem like a kind of imposition or to ask them. I mean, I remember one person that I spoke to very early on was Gary Marshall, who was one of the co-creators of Happy Days and Mork and Mindy, and who had obviously given Robin a hugely important break in his career by, casting him as Mork from Ork. And that was just such a delightful conversation because it was more about Robin's formative days. None of the tragedy or the sadness was encapsulated that. It was about celebrating Robin and remembering him before things really took off for him. And having those kinds of conversations, at an earlier stage in the research process, that that certainly helped fill in a lot of the story, but also, gave me a certain, a sense of confidence or reassurance that little by little we would piece this together. And let's start with, again, people that weren't, so directly connected to what would invariably be the end of the story. Let's talk to the people at the beginning who knew Robin in all these other capacities so that by the time it really is time to start talking to the family, to the very best friends. That way I would have a lot of information that, I could, on the one hand, I could be very judicious about the kinds of questions I would ask the people I was still waiting to hear from. And then also those people could know that I was really doing my homework. That I think one fear that I think understandably a lot of these people might have is, was I trying to write something that would be exploitative of Robin or his legacy? Was it some kind of dirt digging expedition? Was it going to make him look bad, or was it going to paint essentially an incorrect picture of him? Was I going to just make him seem like a really kind of messy person with all these problems in his life? He obviously did have problems, but the more I could show people that I was trying to sort of take in the fullness of his life and also celebrate his talents and his artistic contributions and really, just be as comprehensive as possible, I think, I can't be certain, but I think that put more and more people at ease.
So you're sensitive and you reassure the family, and it sounds like, you sort of start on the periphery of the people who knew him and work your way in toward the closest people in the family to show them that you're doing your homework and you're not wasting their time. And it also made me wonder, do you start with the big picture and sort of fill in the details along the way, or are you more likely to start with some, interesting anecdotes and really key details and then flesh that out to build the big picture over time?
Yeah, I think it's everybody's approach and strategy is going to be different and differ based on the subject of your book. But in my specific case, I literally sat down and made an Excel spreadsheet of every single person I could think of that I would want to talk to, and then sort of grouping them by category, whether it was the people in the immediate family or the people closest around Robin, his managers, his assistant, those kinds of people. Then the comedy people, And then, so, you know, all the stand-ups and the comedy actors that he knew, and then sort of going, you know, through sort of the different eras of his life. So the people that knew him at his various high schools and middle schools, the people that knew him at the different colleges he attended. Juilliard was its own specific little universe because that had some key faculty people that had other students who were famous, students who weren't famous. Then you're talking about his San Francisco comedy career, then his L.A. comedy career, then the Mork and Mindy people, then the Popeye people, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, pretty comprehensive, but trying to keep people grouped by category. And then, you know, there were certain people, like I said, who I knew sort of out of the gate. Don't go right to them. Don't start here, or at least give those people a little more time to process. But then everybody else, it was a little bit of a kind of just a mass outreach, just going one by one through these people and people turning me on to other people, looking at, like, the back of the album cover for Reality, What a Concept, and realizing that Robin acknowledged this one co-writer whose name I had never seen before and seeking out that person. And then he turned into a tremendously valuable source and helped connect me to other people, and so on and so forth. You know, every person, you know, you would get a few doors slammed in your face for sure. But people either, some people were eager to talk or willing to talk. Some people needed a little bit of time but did come around. And often the people who did talk always had suggestions of, hey, here's who else you should try, or have you spoke to so-and-so yet? Oh, no, I haven't, or I wasn't aware of that person. How did they know Robin? And little by little, you know, that plan or that grid, you know, came together.
Right. Oh, it's important to pull on all those little threads and you find surprises.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? Maybe you're bursting with energy, or maybe you're drained because you have a hard time saying no, or you're lonely. It can be easy to ignore your social battery, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. Maybe you want to go, maybe you don't want to go. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And can you recognize what you need and make it happen? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that will keep you fulfilled but won't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/grammargirl today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/grammargirl. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. I've been trying to figure out how to just find more time in my day. And you know what? Factor's ready-to-eat meals come to my door and are on the table in 2 minutes. No more grocery shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleanup. Creamy Parmesan chicken, turkey chili and zucchini with ancho lime crema. These chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals are delicious and take no time at all. Just heat them up and savor the good stuff. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/grammar50 and use the code grammar50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's the code grammar50 at factormeals.com/grammar50. 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box where your subscription is active. Remember the frustration of trying to memorize vocabulary and grammar rules, only to find you couldn't actually use the language in real life? Well, there's a better way to learn. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program with millions of users learning 25 different languages, and you can get it on your desktop or as an app on your phone or tablet. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways with its intuitive process. It's really different. You pick up the language naturally, first with words, then the phrases, and then with sentences. Plus, with Rosetta Stone's true accent feature, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronouncing words. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Grammar Girl listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Is it rosettastone.com/grammar? That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/grammar today.
Are there times when you were working on biographies that your view of the person changed from what you expected it to be? Did you find things that were so surprising that you had to reconsider the way you were framing the story?
Not in this particular case, I would say. In a way, I think Robin was so open about his life, certainly in the later portions of it, about a lot of the misfortunes he had suffered, all the ways that he had wronged other people, and certainly a lot of the the substance abuse, the drugs and the alcohol. That wasn't a secret. So in that sense, I didn't feel like that was any of those things were surprising, or that writing about it was going to somehow upend how people viewed him, or that that was going to disparage him in any way. What I found really fascinating was learning about the start of his life and the origins of his family, and especially about his parents and the lives that they led even before Robin was born. Because I think if you look at sort of the early interviews that Robin gave, he was a little more open, I think, about talking about his parents and at least giving some sense or acknowledgement of really the life of wealth and privilege that he had come from. And then the later he went, he either would kind of fall back on kind of stock answers that, you know, he'd just been asked about those things so many times that he would just kind of, you know, give you like a familiar one-liner, and that was usually satisfactory to whoever he was talking to. Or he started to get a little bit more closed off about himself. He had had a pretty nasty incident after he divorced his first wife and started dating the woman who had become his second wife. They gave this interview to People magazine, and people portrayed it as if he basically, his nanny had robbed the cradle or had basically stolen him away from his first wife. And that experience, I think, so sort of tainted his experience with the press that he became a slightly more walled off person. But to really learn about the way he had been brought up, and that both of his parents had had previous marriages, both had a child from their previous marriage. So Robin had these two half-brothers that he had grown up sort of intermittently alongside. And those brothers, the half-brothers, were also extremely influential people in his life. The parents themselves had led kind of really fascinating lives. His dad was a World War II hero and a real kind of he'd also come from a very wealthy upbringing. The mom was a kind of Southern debutante, and great-great-granddad was a senator and a governor from Mississippi. All these things. It's like, you know, once you understand exactly who the parents are, You realize like there's no other kind of person that they could have turned out except Robin Williams, that he had this one half of himself that was very outgoing, very forthcoming, kind of zany like his mom, and then a part of himself that was very reticent and very hardworking and industrious, but also a little closed off, and that was his dad.
So you were talking about Robin Williams' amazing, interesting, fascinating parents. And I had been wondering how you sort of put yourself in an earlier time. I mean, Robin Williams isn't that much older than you. He was born about 35 years before you were, but still, it's a different time. And so how much of your work goes into understanding the culture from which the person you're writing about came. You know, I imagine back then it was much more unusual, for example, for parents to be divorced, for adults to be divorced and then remarried and have half siblings. And, you know, how much work do you have to do to understand the culture about the person that's the target of your biography?
I think it's extremely important. It was something that I really wanted to be careful about and wanted to be thorough about because, just for starters, those are going to be, unless you're going to take a very kind of unconventional structure in your writing, that's going to be your first chapter, is that person's the earliest years of their life. That's where you're kind of establishing your own authority to your reader. And so if you can't convey that to them, if you don't feel at that stage like you know exactly what you're talking about and where this person came from, you have lost them for all the subsequent chapters. So that was extremely important to me. And I just also found it so interesting as I started learning about these people and the world that Robin came from. To me, I think of comedians for the most part, the people that I write about and encounter and the ones, who usually become famous, they often come from these lives of kind of deprivation, or there's something happened to them in their childhood, something that was withheld from them, or, they were from lower class, or they usually were from minority group. They didn't fit into the wider world, and that's why they turned to comedy. And none of that really applied to Robin, at least not on the outside. So that really, it was a kind of a mystery to begin with, is what drives a person like that, what steers them to the life and the career that he led, because he doesn't fit that mold or that profile. And, you know, I always just find it kind of interesting to just learn about the people who came from, let's say, the era right before me. It's just, I'm a big fan of certainly movies and TV shows from the 60s and 70s. And it just, I don't know, maybe it's a grass is always greener kind of situation, but it just feels like the lives that those people led were a little bit more, they just had more going on. There was a little more grit, a lot more conflict. People got into much worse and much more dangerous situations. They treated themselves and their bodies horribly because they didn't know half the things that we know now. And so all those things, I think, just make them really interesting and fascinating to me.
Right. Yeah, no, it really surprised me when I started reading the book, too, that he had this one very privileged background, a great childhood. It's not what you expect from a comedian. Is the cliche is that, you know, they're troubled. So that was a surprise. And I was thinking, when a book is so great like this one was, I get sucked into the story and I don't think about the bigger writing issues. But I found myself wondering about biographies or memoirs, do you, as a writer, do you sort of follow the same story structure? Are you thinking about story structure with the conflict, you know, the three conflicts or the hero's journey, or, you know, some way of framing the story like, fiction writers do? Are you thinking about story structure when you're putting the work together?
Yeah, I don't think I'm sort of taking the kind of the Joseph Campbell approach of, you know, which archetype does this fall into? But certainly structure is important. Thinking about what the big themes, the through lines are going to be, because particularly in Robin's life, there are beats that kind of keep coming up, whether it's, certain kinds of movies and movies he likes to make and characters he likes to play, or misfortunes that he's going to suffer. Certainly kind of... in his own mind, certain fears, certain, phobias that he has, what if this happens to me, and then sadly sees them realized in his life and career to a certain extent. And we know how the story is going to end, too. And so you're trying to, in some ways, flag to your reader, like, we know where this is going. Keep this in mind. Remember this. Like, here's a little, just a little, outro from an episode of Mork and Mindy that's really kind of bittersweet and all about the, the burdens of celebrity. That's going to be really important later on. Here's a kind of throwaway Saturday Night Live skit that he did in the 80s where he's already kind of ruminating on old age and losing his career and his fans. That's going to be important later, too. So, the one advantage you have is that you know where the story is going, and so you can point your camera wherever it makes the most sense, and you can decide what to emphasize, or you can sort of give your reader a little tap on the shoulder and say, you know, remember this. So I think certainly laying that all out in front of you as best you can before you start to write is supremely important, and just writing an outline, you know, for the breadth of the book, writing chapter by chapter outlines was very important. And then just writing, I guess that's the best way to put it. And in the writing, things come up, you remember, you're not, it's not like you're Charles Dickens and you have to keep publishing something every week. You're kind of writing it in, you know, you have it in your, you know, in your computer, and you can say, oh, hey, I remember I put this thing in chapter 16. That reminds me of this thing way back in chapter 2. Did I remember to set that up so that this pays off? Oh, I didn't. Let me go back to chapter 2 and put that back in. You know, all those kinds of strategies.
Great. Do you write just in a word processing program, or do you use sort of more of a story management program?
No, I just use Microsoft Word. But I still am big on notebooks and note cards, like very old school kind of tactile, paraphernalia like that. I realize it's a little outdated, and maybe, you know, this.
No, no, I do that too. Or maybe we're both outdated.
maybe, you know, for another, this, you know, if I had a project where I had sort of infinite time, or I wasn't stressing about a deadline, maybe I would, try out, you know, there are obviously a lot more sophisticated computer programs to do all these sorts of things, and to take the place of the big note card pile. So I'm open to adapting my strategies, but just for this particular project, because I just wanted to get everything just right. There was really no room for this was not the time to teach an old dog new tricks.
And so for you, what do you think, what's the hardest part for you of writing a biography? What's the part that you struggle with the most?
I guess it's an interesting question. I think it's maybe it's, you know, when you sort of flip the switch from the research mode to the writing mode, because in some ways you could always be doing one more interview or looking at one more archival source or tracking down one more magazine article or whatever it is. There's always a little bit more. And frankly, even in the course of writing the book, there were a couple of pretty important interviews that came through fairly late in the game, not too late. And I was very grateful to have them. But that was at times a source of anxiety, and I certainly could have lived without that. But it's just not the way that the industry works, or that people's lives work. At a certain point, you've just got to say, okay, I got to start writing this thing one way or another, and let the chips fall where they may. And so that was like making that kind of transition was probably a little stressful, to say, okay, now I'm really in a writing mode, and to some extent just writing the very first chapter and trying to figure out, well, what is the tone going to be? How do I, you know, even though a reader comes in knowing who the book is about, like those first few pages are going to say a lot to them about the story they're about to read, and how I view Robin, and how and my perspective on his world. What do I say? It was supremely important. You can really get fixated on that for a while, and I know I did.
Yeah, I was wondering if the tone comes more from you or more from Robin. You know, are you thinking of his voice when you're writing, or is it really your voice?
I know what you mean. I mean, I think it would be very dangerous of me if I were to try to write the book in some kind of tone like I'm emulating him, because he was so singular, and you see people fall on their face all the time trying to do even a kind of half-assed, imitation or impersonation of him. And I hope people, I tried to sprinkle some humor throughout the book, but I didn't necessarily want this to be a humorous book per se, or to try to show off, like, look how funny I can be. I think you want the tone to be dictated by how you think about the subject and also sort of where you are in their life at different times. There are certainly parts of Robin's life that are tremendously exciting. And when his career is taking off and just going to these astronomical heights that nobody really had achieved and very few have reached since, it's thrilling. And you want the reader to kind of feel that momentum and to be caught up in that and to get a kind of secondhand joy from it. And sadly, of course, you know there are parts that are going to be terribly tragic. It's going to have just no way to avoid some of the realities of how Robin's life ended. And you also want to prepare people for that. You don't want to just suddenly turn on a dime and have it feel really bleak. I think you really want people to be ready for that and know that it's coming and just kind of have that feel as smooth as possible when they do arrive at it.
Right. Well, this project came across my desk because you're creating a podcast based on the book. So can you tell us more about sort of how that came about and especially like what it's going to be like and where people can find it?
It's a very new thing to me. I don't want to take full credit or even partial credit because it's something that, Macmillan, which is the parent company of Holt, which published the book, they were all very kind enough to come to me and say they thought that there was a potential, an opportunity for a podcast to be made around this book, which I thought was a terrific idea. I think that Robin is just a person that we, even though we have been without him for 5 years now, we still like to re-immerse ourselves in the work that he did and learn about his life and remember what was great about it. And so this seemed like just another opportunity to have people experience that in a medium that I've been a podcast guest, and that's about the extent to which I've that I know podcasts. So to see I'm just one participant in it. You'll hear my voice in it a lot, but also many other people, some people who were primary sources for the book who are giving new interviews, people that I maybe missed the first time around, or other people who have important connections to Robin who have slightly different stories to share that maybe weren't right for a biography but will still illuminate him and his life, also participating. And, I get to just also be a kind of fan of it and discover how the podcast turns out and still get to go home to my wife and my son at the end of the day and not have to stress about it.
And what's it going to be called?
It's going to be called Knowing Robin Williams.
Oh, nice. That's going to be great.
Thank you.
And so that'll come out really soon. It might be available now.
Anything's possible. The internet is a crazy place.
Right. We can't predict.
That's right.
But knowing Robin Williams.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Dave Itzikoff, for being here with me today. It was wonderful to hear about your process in writing this book. Where's the best place for people to find you online besides the podcast?
Right. I am usually on Twitter at DItzikoff, DItzKoff. And you can read me in the New York Times.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Mignon Fogarty, better known as Grammar Girl. You can find a transcript of this podcast and all the other great Quick and Dirty Tips podcasters at quickanddirtytips.com. And if you're looking for a fun holiday gift, I know, I'm sorry it's that time of year already, you might want to check out my card game, Peeve Wars. I hardly ever mention it, but it's a fun, family-friendly game you can play in about 20 minutes. People love it. The cards are all cartoon pet peeves, and the goal is to amass an army of peeves and annoy your opponents to death. It's sold through a company called Gamecrafter, and you can find it by doing a Google search for Grammar Girl Peeve Wars. Thanks to my producer, Nathan Sims. And that's all. Thanks for listening.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.